Welcome to The Elephant, made with the support of the Climate Kick Alumni Association. I'm Kevin Caners.
Je regarde la salle. Je vois que la réaction est positive. Je n'entends pas d'objection. L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
Those are the sounds from the moment when the Paris Agreement was struck, when delegates representing 195 countries from around the world reached a landmark deal to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Now, there are a few main parts to the agreement, but at its core was the declaration that the nations of the world would collectively take action to keep the increase in global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius. The accord was heralded as historic by the media and by politicians, but in some ways, it was incredibly short on specifics about how we're going to get there. So you might wonder, what will it actually take for us to meet these goals? And what does science tell us about by how much and how fast we'll need to cut our emissions in order to make what was declared in Paris a reality? Well, answering that question is exactly the area that Kevin Anderson works in. He's a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester, and he's the deputy director of the influential Tyndall Center. Kevin takes what we know from climate science and applies knowledge from other fields, like engineering and policy. He does this to map out various scenarios or emissions curves that would allow us to stay within our carbon budget and have a high probability of meeting the goals we've set. And I'm afraid he doesn't have good news for us. You see, the thing is, we've waited a really long time.
All of your life, people of my generation have chosen to do absolutely nothing about climate change. Worse than doing nothing, we've actually watched the emissions go up.
In fact, we've waited so long that despite what we agreed to in Paris, the window for us to actually be able to meet 2 degrees is extremely tight, and that window is closing quickly. So quickly that many scientists wonder if we can meet it at all.
We've squandered almost all of our carbon budget for 2 degrees centigrade, and therefore, we now face these dire political repercussions that are about today.
Kevin points out that climate change isn't about 2100 or the next 50 years, because not only has it already arrived, due to the carbon budget we have left, it's really the next 5 years that will determine what kind of world we're left with for generations to come. You know, this conversation was tough for me, and I've thought about it a lot since, because the picture he paints is bleak. And I think for the first time in talking to Kevin, it really hit me how much we're up against and how much more urgency there needs to be if we're going to keep really terrible things from happening. But I keep thinking about something that Kevin said in this interview, that true hope, if there is any to have, comes from first dealing with the facts of the matter, no matter how bleak. And I think that's true. So in order to be prepared to push for the transformation that needs to take place within our society, we first need to look at where we're at, and Kevin is a great guide into exactly that question. So here's my interview with Kevin Anderson. I caught up with Kevin while we were in Paris for COP21. We got to the specifics behind what will need to happen in order for us to meet the goals that were set in Paris. But first, I started off by asking Kevin if he's been to these COP meetings before.
I've only been to one, or one and a half, I should say. I don't fly, and therefore I'm a bit limited to which ones I can go to with sufficient degree of ease.
So you don't fly?
I've not flown for 11 years, no. But yeah, you can have a reasonable academic career still. Yeah, as an academic without flying, it's challenging. There are certainly certain parts of my life, some of which are professional, some of which are personal, which are more difficult. But ultimately, from a professional point of view, actually, I don't think it's that limiting. Depends exactly what your research area is. I still travel a reasonable amount, but when I go, I tend to plan it a lot more in advance, and I go for longer, because it takes longer to get there, so I plan to do much more when I'm there. So I don't tend to go for short one-day events, or even two or three-day events. I generally tend to go, I'll say, well, I can do this, and then I'll plan something for, say, a week or a fortnight, or maybe a month sometimes.
And why have you made this decision?
Basically, two reasons, but they're obviously both related. It's a carbon dioxide emission reason. I work on climate change. And one of the conclusions I draw from mine and others' research is that those of us who are responsible for the lion's share of emissions have to make very dramatic changes to how we live our lives to reduce our emissions. Now, that in itself, you know, me making these reductions for my emissions, is not necessarily important at a bigger picture level. But that I then try and discuss that with other people. It helps encourage a different way of viewing these things. So a lot of my colleagues take a different view towards their flying. I know lots of other academics now who think quite differently about flying than they did before. So what you do is you catalyze, or you may catalyze a sort of change, a different mindset. So I think you can, as individuals, I think you can be a real agent for change. But it's not just what the emissions are from yourself. It's actually how do you communicate that, and you have to be quite vociferous and thick-skinned and stubborn, I think, to push these things forward.
Thick-skinned?
Thick-skinned means that you're going to get a lot of criticism.
So have you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And particularly from other high-level colleagues who want to justify their incredibly carbon-profligate lives, who spend half their lives on planes, and the more senior ones, half their lives on business-class planes as well. And they don't like the idea you're questioning these things. So some people find it very uncomfortable. But also academics across the board don't find that easy because they regularly like to go to conferences. They will always say it's about the information and the knowledge. Actually, deep down, there is still something about flying as a positional good. It makes us feel good about ourselves because other people aren't doing it, even though the flying itself is often quite uncomfortable. So I still think it has some symbolism of the sort of luxury of a particular group of society from the 1950s, even though in practice the flying is nothing like that anymore. But I think people who fly generally are people who are in the much wealthier category in society. So it says something about us as individuals, our success, because we measure our success generally in terms of wealth.
Now, I've kind of thought about this question myself, and I remember something that Noam Chomsky said. I mean, it's a slightly different example because it's not about emissions, but just in terms of like buying clothing what we eat. And he made the point that, well, sure, to the degree that it doesn't take up all your energy, you can try to make good choices. But if you're spending all your time and energy trying to make the right decisions, then it's kind of a waste of effort because the effort should be going into changing the defaults of the system. What do you think about that?
Well, it is both, but I don't see the system as separate necessarily from the individual. I don't really like this idea of top-down or bottom-up. I may agree with a lot of what Chomsky has said over many years on lots of issues, but I don't particularly like the division of society into top-down and bottom-up. I see if we make the changes, if we then talk about that within our family group, our social group, our work community, if we discuss in universities with our heads of school, our VCs, or with our companies, with our bosses and so forth, we can discuss these things. We can try to catalyze and foster a system-level change. Ultimately, of course, I agree, you have to get that system-level change. But system-level changes don't just emerge from nowhere. Something triggers them. And we could be those triggers. Now, we may well fail when we try to do this, but even when we fail in trying to catalyze change, we may have helped make someone else think about something differently. So we don't know where else their new ideas may percolate out to the system. In this sense, it makes all 7 billion of us stakeholders. Now, we may approach this differently. Some people may prefer to take oil companies to court or to battle with their politicians. Others may prefer to demonstrate change themselves and try to catalyze that within their local environment and then say, look, hey, we've managed to do this as a community, as a university, whatever it might be. And the divestment movement is a very good example. Yeah, it emerged from some sort of little nugget and then it spread, and now it's become much more mainstream. It is becoming, you can see the divestment movement helping make a system change.
So I guess you're saying we need both strategies, all types of strategies.
We do need all types of strategies, yes. But I don't like the idea of saying it's just about individuals. I don't think, really in a complex system, individuals don't really exist. You know, we are all part of the system. So we have the ability to catalyze change within our system.
Now, one of the, maybe you can explain it better and more fully than me after I'm done, but so one of the primary things you do is you look at the official targets, like 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, and then sort of reverse engineer it and say, well, what would that mean to get there? Can you just describe a bit about what that work involves?
Yes. We have these, let's just take the 2 degrees C target. We have a 2 degrees C, and I don't like calling it a target. I see it's an obligation or a duty. If you look at the language that was wrapped around it, it was never about a target. It was, we will take the action. Not we may take the action, we'll try and take the action. It's we will take the action to keep the temperature below 2 degrees centigrade. It doesn't say a 50-50 chance of or a 75% chance of exceeding. It says below 2 degrees centigrade.
Is this the Copenhagen Accord you're referring to?
The Copenhagen Accord, but it could be the Camp David Agreement. It means almost every single year governments sign up to the same sort of language, consistent with science and on the basis of equity. I always use the Copenhagen Accord because it's the neatest encapsulation of this. But it's the same language that's used repeatedly. So I don't see it as a target. I see it much more as an obligation or a duty, and I think that changes your perception of how important it is. So, but let's be clear, the 2 degrees C framing is not something that scientists derived. It is something that came out of civil society. Science informs that debate. Science can tell you what the impacts might be at certain temperatures in certain parts of the world, that sort of thing. But whether that set of impacts are seen to be dangerous or not is the role of civil society and the sort of messy process of international negotiations. And unfortunately, that messy process has been dominated, if we're blunt about it, by rich, white, generally men in the Northern Hemisphere. And we now have this target of 2°C. And what we're hearing here in Paris is that there are many people around the world who think we should go for a lower target of 1.5. And they have a very legitimate case for that. Nevertheless, we have this agreement around 2°C, even though, as I say, it's 2°C is likely to be dangerous and deadly for many of the poor communities. It's then the role of people like me to take that and say, well, what does science tell us about 2°C? What would we need to deliver in terms of emission reductions? Now, the science tells us very clearly, and particularly the latest IPCC report, that for a temperature rise across the century, we have a set carbon budget, a total amount of carbon dioxide that we can emit into the atmosphere. And then we can, quite easily as scientists, we can start to translate to what does that mean in terms of the mitigation rates, how fast we have to reduce our emissions. We know what the current level of emissions are. We might make some assumptions about emissions from, say, deforestation or from cement use, so we can then work out what's the emissions from energy, the bit I focus on. So we might make certain sets of assumptions, but they can be very clear and obvious assumptions. You can adjust those a little bit up and down. But in the end of the day, we have a very clear carbon budget, and whoever you adjust these bits of detail, the same message comes out. We need rapid and deep reductions, probably bordering on the 10% per annum level.
Yeah. Let me pick back up on that in a second, but first, let me get this idea of the carbon budget straight. So basically, we can calculate more or less how much carbon we can collectively burn until we definitely go over that 2-degree line?
Yes. I mean, there's a bit more to it than that, but yes. If we're talking about stabilizing atmospheric temperature of a 2°C rise by the end of the century, we have a set of carbon budgets. Now, they vary a bit with the probability. Do you want a very good chance of it? So, it's not really a very good chance, but the best that we're using is a 66% chance of staying below 2°C, or do you want a 50-50 chance, or just a 30% chance of staying below 2°C? And they all have a different carbon budget associated with them. And that is the total amount of carbon dioxide we can emit into the atmosphere between 2011 and 2100. Now, we could have done it earlier or later, but that's the budget range they've given in the IPCC report. And we understand that fairly clearly, and there is a very high correlation between temperature and the total amount of CO2 we put in the atmosphere.
So when you crunch the numbers and kind of look at the carbon budget that would keep us below this threshold, what do you come away with?
Okay, well, firstly, there's very little of the carbon budget left. That's one of the reasons that some of the arguments that I'm making look a little bit different to some of the other arguments you may hear in Paris. We are in now 2015, with the end of 2015, and the carbon budgets in the IPCC report are from 2011. So we've already emitted, since 2011, 150 billion tons of carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. Now that's 15% of the budget for a good chance of 2°C, gone. So you always have to say, well, that's already spent. If you imagine it like a bank balance, that £15 out of your £100 in the bank has now gone. So we then have to say, well, how much do we think we're going to use? In my case, because I focus on energy, I want to know how much we're going to use for the emissions from cement. When we use cement, it emits carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the process of using cement. Cement is about the second most used material on the planet. We use it for wind turbine foundations, for nuclear power foundations, for roads, for rail networks. Almost all of our buildings have cement bases to them, and of cement in the construction. Industrialization, or the development, if you want to use that term, for the poor parts of the world will also involve lots and lots of cement. So I then look at that, how that may play out in the future.
And cement emits a lot of CO2?
Yeah, it does. Actually, you require a lot of energy to make the cement, but that could be low carbon. But the process emissions, the actual process, the chemical process of making cement, releases huge quantities of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I've tried to take account of those, being very optimistic about what the technology can do to change it. And so I take account of that. I also take account of the emissions from deforestation, which is still ongoing, even though we could do something about it. But nevertheless, it is ongoing, and it is likely to remain ongoing for the next few years at least. So we make some estimate of all of these, and then we reduce that from the carbon budget as well. So the carbon budget that we have in the end,